this politician talking about his brand new mission. Liked his plans, but they came undone when he got around to God and guns. I don't know how he grew up, but it sure wasn't down at the hunting club. Cause if it was, he'd understand just a little bit more about the working man. God and guns keep us strong. That's what this country was founded on. Well, we might as well give up and run. If we let them take our God and guns. Yeah, out here in my neck of the woods, where God's great and guns are good, you really can't know that much about them if you think we're better off without them. Oh, there was a time we ain't forgot, you could rest all night. Doors unlocked, but there ain't nobody safe no more. So you say your prayers and you thank the Lord for that peacemaker in the chest of drawers.
Patriot Studios, this is Soldiers of Patriotism.
And good Sunday afternoon to you all, princes and princesses of patriotism. It is Sunday, September 23rd, 2012. Folks, we've got 44 days until we reclaim our country. Uncle Big and I have a great show lined up for you today with a very special guest. Former Navy SEAL and author of Battle on the Home Front, Carl Higbee, will be joining us. And I am so excited. I got the opportunity to listen to this man a month or so ago here locally on a radio station that I listen to. Instantly made contact with him, told him I was going to read the book and I'd like to have him on, all of which has happened. So Bing and I are very excited to have this man on. With that, let me go ahead and jump into my opening editorial, which starts with a poem I penned this morning. The editorial itself is called Moving Rock, Freedom, and Character, Carl Higbee. Wake up to Obama blues. Can't shake the news. All the way to the White House, they're lying. The intrigues of the new castrati and the believers in socialism share the same linen pages. Democrat campaign saw a sovereign flag as they raised their glasses to conquest of nation. Steelborns playing out the legacy of long-dead ideology titans and haters of men. Aborted babies, social chaos, proud symbols of cavalier progress. Memories of freedom and triage, disappearing freedoms, permanent changes. No citizen will have a final say. Everyone knows the citizen is guilty. Faced with no plan at all, just to trick a smile of the moment. Folks, I spent 4 years as a Cub Scout master when my oldest boy, Quinn, was a Cub Scout. And there was a campfire story I would tell my boys in the pack. One Saturday morning, a young boy was playing in his sandbox. He had all his cars and trucks, his plastic pail, his plastic shovel, while creating roads and tunnels in the soft sand. He discovered a large rock in the middle of the sandbox. The boy dug around the rock, managing to dislodge it from the sand. With a bit of a struggle, he pushed and he nudged that rock across the sandbox using his feet. When the boy got the rock to the edge of the sandbox, however, he found that he could not roll it up and over the little wall. Determined, the little boy shoved. He pushed. He pried. But every time he made some progress, the rock tipped back and then fell back into the sandbox. He grunted. He struggled. He pushed and he shoved. But his only reward was to have the rock roll back. The boy's father watched from the living room window as the drama unfolded. The moment the tears fell, a large shadow fell across the boy in the sandbox. It was the boy's father. Gently but firmly, he said, "Son, why didn't you use all the strength you had available?" Defeated, the boy sobbed back, "But I did, Daddy, I did. I used all the strength I had." Squatting down to his son's level, he embraced the boy, looked him in the eyes, and lovingly said, "No, son, you didn't use all the strength you had. You didn't ask me. You didn't ask me." With that, the father reached down and lifted the rock from the sandbox. Patriots, Uncle Bing and I are proud and honored today to have as our guest a man who not only answered his country's call for help, but helped to pick up that rock of terrorism and start moving it out of our way. That man is former Navy SEAL Carl Higbee. Let me tell you a little bit about Carl. He served as a Navy SEAL for 9 years, but was threatened with a dishonorable discharge for speaking out against President Obama's policies and writing a book, Battle on the Home Front. In a Fox interview on August 12th, Higbee said, "My commanders were more concerned about how the fallout of this book would affect their careers than they were concerned about how reelecting President Obama would affect the country." Battle on the Home Front is an in-your-face, no-holds-barred expose of America today. Carl pulls no punches, and I got to tell you, he doesn't. He tells it like it is. He calls names of prominent politicians or political and public figures, and he lays it all out on the line. It's 143 pages. It's a great read, and I highly recommend that you get it and you read it. So without any further ado, let me go ahead and bring on in here Uncle Bing so we can get Carl on. Uncle Bing, how's it going today, brother?
Pretty good, man. I didn't have but a couple hours sleep last night, but, you know, I'm feeling pretty good and looking forward to hearing Carl talk again. And, you know, in your monologue, you know, I mean, you just got to sometimes ask for help, man. Sometimes you just can't do it all yourself, you know, and that's what teamwork is about. So very good.
Well, and Carl personifies that story, that little Cub Scout story that I told, you know, that, to a bunch of 10-year-old boys, it probably doesn't mean anything. Probably to most people, it doesn't mean anything. But the moral of the story is more than just the father to the son. It's the citizen to the country. It's standing up for righteousness and being right. And I thought the story was appropriate to having Carl on today.
Well, yeah, when there's a rock in a hard place and you can't get rid of it, man, you need some help. And, you know, that's where Carl comes in.
You know what you do when you're in a rock in a hard spot? You bring in a Navy SEAL. With that, Bing, let's bring on here Mr. Carl Higbee. Come on in here, brother.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Carl. Basically, we just like to give our folks the floor and let them talk to us. I do have a few questions, but we'll just take them one at a time. With that, unless Bing's got anything for you, I want to say thank you and turn it over to you.
All right. Well, Uncle Bing, you got anything?
I just wanted to say, man, thanks for your service. in the military and out of it, because actually I think you're probably doing a lot more good out of it.
Well,
I just wanted
to
say thank you, and I know everybody here wants to say thank you too.
Well, I appreciate it, and I tell everybody that I meet, it's the support that makes it worth it. You know, it really wouldn't be worth it if there weren't good, hearty Americans, you know, rooting for us and thanking us for doing what we do, and that's what it's all about. But thanks for having me on. Sorry, it took so long to get you a slot here, but you guys are the heart and soul of America. Programs like yours and everything like that, I love coming on. I love talking to you guys because you really represent what the people who get up every morning and put their boots on and go to work want to hear.
Well, we appreciate that, Carl. And, it's like I said in the opening there, I heard you on Mark Davis's show here. And, you know, as you know, I'm in the Metroplex in Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Right.
And I got the opportunity to listen to you then and was just floored. Got the book, contacted you. I made a few notes as I was reading. The very first thing that struck me is something that I believe wholeheartedly. I got to tell you, Carl, when I read your book, it was my thoughts. If I were to write a book, it was everything I would have said with a lot of just the basic what's facing America issues, which is a good chunk of the book.
How it was written. It was written like two guys around a campfire having beers.
Exactly. I couldn't have put it better.
Yeah.
And you opened up, excuse me, I have a bit of a sore throat. You opened up, you said today, the liberal side of, let me put my glasses on here so I can read. The liberal side of the spectrum is trying to degrade religious faith or take God and organized religion out of this country. Now, I want to get your thoughts on that, Carl, to start with, because I have been of the opinion, and that's kind of where you, I mean, it was a great chapter at the beginning of the book. I've expounded on that in previous rants and diatribes that I've had, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, Carl. And I believe the reason they're doing this, and this is why I want your thoughts, is especially as a service member and someone that understands democracy and freedom and everything this country stands for, that you might can elaborate on this. When you take God out of the public square, when you take faith away from its citizens, you leave them with nothing but an overbearing government to tell them how to think, because they no longer have faith in anything.
Right. Well, it goes further than that, too. It goes to, if you want a society that's accepting of, you know, the abortion and the multiculturalism, where we bend over backwards for radical Islam and homosexuality, if you want a society that's going to accept that, you would first need to abolish the morals. And like the article in the book, Katie Witherman's article, I'm not comparing Obama or his administration to Hitler, but there's striking similarities to the methods that were used to establish big governmental power, and one of them was to drop morals. And when you drop the morals, which the Judeo-Christian faith, which founded our country, when you drop those morals of that faith, it's a lot easier for the government to swoop in, because there's a void that needs to be filled. And that's, I believe that is truly what the liberal, you know, the liberal left is trying to do to this country. They're trying to create a void so they can fill it with governmental power. You know, the government is using short-term problems now to make permanent expansions, like the deficit.
Well, yeah, they're using class warfare, basically, too. You know, they're using anything that they can to further their agenda on the liberal side.
Right.
Carl, tell us, how did you, what inspired you? I know because I read the book, but for those that have not read it yet, well, first of all, tell us a little bit, give us a little bit of your history, Carl. I think, I know your history. Tell us a little bit. I loved the beginning of the book when you talked about going through school and not being satisfied. You sound a whole lot like me, though I'm probably 20 years your senior. But when I was 20 years ago, you sound exactly like kind of that ADD almost. I was 82nd Airborne. I didn't go all as far as you did, but I was gung-ho. I became dissatisfied with the service after 6 years. And got out, but I had broken my back. I used to rodeo as well when I was in the service, and I broke my back, and I got terminated from jump status medically. Well, that was the end of it for me because I couldn't stand to be in the leg army. I was there to be a John Wayne soldier. I had ambitions of being special forces. When they took my wings, or when I lost my jump status, it ruined it for me. So tell us a little bit about yourself growing up, the mentality. Mr. Mississippi must have put a hell of a foundation underneath you to have the fortitude to go through what I know you went through to be a Navy SEAL.
Well, I tell you, you know, it was both my grandparents, both my grandfathers were, one was a colonel and one was a Navy officer. So he was an Army colonel and a Navy officer. So, you know, my parents weren't oriented towards the military. They were very business oriented. So it was a bit of a shock to them when I told them I wanted to join. I'd always said, hey, I want to do this, but they never really, they were like, oh, that'd be nice. And finally, just, I was sick of it. I saw it in college. I saw this nation deteriorating. 9/11 was the big decision maker for me. And once we declared the war on terror, I was like, all right, let's do this. And I had to go be a part of it.
Yeah. In the book, you said you were ready. You walked into the recruiter and you were ready to leave right then, ready to hit the airplane.
Well, that's what I told him. I said, hey, man, I'm here to be a SEAL and I need you to fill out some paperwork so I can go do it. He laughed at me and I was like, no, I'm serious. And I told the guy, I said, you know, he was like, when do you want to leave? And I was like, I don't know. I looked at my watch, 15 minutes. An hour? I don't know. How much do you need? He's like, well, the soonest we could get you out there is like April of next year. And it was October. So I'm looking at this guy. I'm like, dude, did we just declare a global war on terror? And the soonest you can get me in to being a Navy SEAL is 7 months? Like, no wonder our nation's falling apart. Like, I mean, God bless the government, right?
Yeah, well, you do. You know, you and I, Carl, and anyone that's a veteran knows, sometimes the bureaucracy, I'm trying to be polite because, you know, I'm like you. I mean, I love my country. I love serving. But there's a lot of, I'd say, ineptness in a lot of the redundancy and whatnot for just getting in, something as simple. Because I was basically like you. I went in, said, I'm ready to leave next week. You know, want to leave next week.
Yeah, there's the problem with the problem with the military is they spend more time creating jobs for people than they do completing the tasks that they're assigned. I mean, there are commands all the way across the military that do nothing. All it is a stovepipe between other two commands. And the only reason that command was created was so some captain, colonel, commander, general, admiral, whatever could have a command under his belt for his next promotion board. That's the only reason, and it's unfortunate. They stovepipe everything.
So, you know, go ahead.
You kind of touched on this, Michael, but I just had a question. Like, was there a spark for you to write this book, Carl, or was there something that just turned in your life and you said you had to write this book? What was that, or was it just the culmination of things?
The real thing that pushed me over the edge was, you know, I talked about it in the book, is we were court-martialed. We went out, and you're all familiar with the Blackwater Bridge contractor killings back in Fallujah in 2002, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was an unknown terrorist captured Americans. Two of them were former SEALs, or one or two of them were former SEALs, and killed them. Dragged their bodies through the streets of Fallujah, lit them on fire, and hung them from a bridge. And so we caught the guy while we were out there. And this guy, he was on the target deck for a long time, and we finally found him. We got him, and we bring him back to our prison facility. We stick him in the holding facility, and nothing happened. This guy complained of prisoner abuse. And we were investigated for it, and the Navy wanted to cover their back, so they investigated us. They did a thorough questioning of all the people there, and they came back to our command, to our commanding officer, who was a SEAL, and said, either this is the best corroborated story I've ever seen in my entire career, or these guys didn't do it. He's like, I'm leaning to the latter. And the commanding officer said, looked at this NCIS guy and goes, find something. This is not going on my shoulders. And we were court-martialed. Well, I say eight of us were originally charged, and they were going to generals mask us, which would have been judge, jury, and executioner with no evidence presented. So we all requested court-martial, and it was charges were dropped on five of us and three of my very close friends that I stood trial for, were court-martialed and hung out to dry and ruined their careers. We all got acquitted, but all of our careers suffered because of administrative reasons. They were like, well, you know, you can't go here now, and now this is out of whack, and you're not allowed to do certain jobs anymore because of your publicity from that trial. It's like, well, we were innocent, but not really. You know, it affected our careers just the same. So that really sparked it. I was like, I'm going to be hung out by my own government, by my own commanding officer who's a fellow SEAL, because a terrorist complained that we gave him a bloody lip with no factual basis. And I was like, wow, they took the word of this guy over eight combat decorated SEALs. It's nauseating.
It's disgusting, is what it is.
It is, Michael. And Michael, you know, down in Texas, you got the two border agents killed down there. Or not killed, but put in jail over shooting at a drug dealer that was crossing the border. I mean, it's the same thing. And they crucify these two Border Patrol agents, and I think they're both out now. But they had to go to jail. They had to serve jail time. And the dude comes in again and brings in more marijuana. And he's basically laughing all the way to the bank. That was Lopez and some. I don't remember. There was two guys. I don't remember their names off the top of my head. But, I mean, that was in Texas, man.
I say congratulations to the government for that, because now what they've done is they've made an example out of those two. And they've taught border agents that if you shoot at a person, even if you think you're justified, if you shoot at a criminal doing criminal things or try to apprehend him or anything, you are going to go to jail. So congratulations, United States government, because now our border agents are going to turn the other way and just not want to engage in it because they're worried about their own personal career.
Well, with those border agents, too, that was the Obama Department of Justice. And I recall the incident with you, Carl, and I didn't realize that you were one of those eight. I must have missed that. But that was the Obama Department of Justice, or was that the Department of Navy?
Ours is actually the Department of the Army, because we were deployed under General Cleveland, who was the commanding general for the area, and we were a SEAL command under an Army general somehow. I don't know how that works, but so it was pushed by our CO, our commanding officer, who actually subsequently made extra rank after that whole thing went down anyway, and now he's in charge of even more stuff. So it was the Department of the Army that pushed it, and we got no support from anyone. We had congressmen and senators write letters on our behalf and didn't do anything. We went to court-martial, and there was no case.
The administration could have halted that at any time had they wanted to. That just shows you the disdain for our country and for our service members that the left has.
Right. And that's why people shouldn't be in the Congress, Senate, or the executive branch without military service. I really don't think they should.
I've always been torn on that. Same with term limits, but I'm beginning to come to that evolution of thinking, and I know that gets away from having citizen, it being a citizen Congress. But I mean, you're still a citizen even if you're prior service. But I think I have to agree with you, Carl, because these men and women are sending people into harm's way, and which a service member will gladly do, and if ordered to do it, but then to have these same people play games like they did in Vietnam, and and the games that have been played with you and the Navy SEALs that were brought up on charges for these poor little terrorists. Screw them. They wouldn't have been doing what they were doing. They wouldn't have got a freaking bloody lip in the first place.
Exactly. I mean, we're America. We're a superpower, and we're the best country that there has ever been, and we need to start acting like it.
I couldn't agree more.
So, I would go one step further and say we're a megapower, but we're losing that status, We're not just a superpower like, Russia and all these other, but we're a megapower, and we have to start acting like it. We're not acting like it. We're kissing the hands of dictators and despots and freaks out there, and it sickens me to see it. Yep. You know, we got Benjamin Netanyahu, who, you know, is, you know, Prime Minister of Israel, one of our closest allies over there in the Middle East. We prop up the Muslim Brotherhood. We got Benjamin Netanyahu, and he can't meet with the president because he's too busy on his campaign mode, which he's been in campaign mode since day one, since he got elected. So, I mean,
since he got elected as a senator, he was in campaign mode. He only served half a term of Senate.
Yeah. To me, it's a travesty. I mean, I'm sitting there waiting for him to meet with the Iranian leader,
Ahmadinejad.
Yeah, because he's in New York. Yeah, but he's in New York now, I think. So, I mean, it makes a mind just sit there and wonder, what is going on, man? What is going on?
Yeah, it really does.
Carl, In your chapter, Selfish, Ignorant People and the Effect on America, there was at the beginning of that chapter something that kind of stuck out. I'm trying to flip to it, but fortunately I have it written here. It's just that I write so horribly. But something that stuck out in my mind, because we heard this so much, especially when President Bush was still the president, and that is, let me get my eyeballs back on here. Many Americans stateside are very supportive of the troops, but lost faith in the cause. Now, and we all understand what you mean, but I wanted you to expand on that a little bit. And as a soldier, when you came home, how did it feel? How did you react? What did you say to folks that said, "Man, thank you for your service. I appreciate you. I supported you, but that Bush, he's an ignorant SOB or whatever."
I mean, it was frustrating because a lot of these people like, "Oh yeah, I support the troops. And you know, it just seems like just a PR statement that's drafted from some of these people. And I'm like, because they'll openly be like, "Oh, but it's so stupid to go in there." And it's like, do you even know why we're there? Do you know why we went in there? Do you know why we're still there? Like, do you know? I mean, first off, if you ask a general right now what is the desired end result for Afghanistan, they'll probably say regional stability. And then you'll ask them to define that, and they'll use smoke and mirrors and won't actually give you an answer. So we don't have a definitive answer or a goal for that area. But a lot of these people will say, you know, "Oh, I think we're over there killing innocent civilians." And I was like, "So you think we as in the troops, are over there killing innocent civilians, but you still support me? So you disagree with me killing innocent civilians, but you support the fact that I'm over there doing that." I was like,
"Yeah,
you're a moron."
You had a good story in the book about that incident with two college students at a bread place. Care to share that with us?
You know, it was the typical guys. They would have fit in great at Occupy Wall Street. And these skinny, scrawny little hippies, and I'm not a big fan of hippies to begin with, so these guys come in and they're talking about Bush and they're shooting him down and they're stupid. You know, "Oh, Bush is stupid. The war is stupid." And I snapped at these guys. I was like, "Have you ever, you know, been to Iraq or Afghanistan? Do you know what you're talking about?" They're like, and they looked at me in this smug look like, "No, we're in college, so we don't have to join the military." And I looked at these guys. I was like, I really just wanted to bounce their heads off my knee. Because I wish you could have seen the smug look on their face. They snickered when they said, "Oh, actually, yeah, we're in college. We don't have to join the military." I said, "Well, you know what? I lost 3 good friends on my last deployment in very close proximity, and they all had college degrees. They all had kids. And I bet they're never going to be as ungrateful as you are." It just... That kind of mentality just bothered me to no extent. And then the people, when I called them out on that, you know, I used a couple 4-letter words and was pretty explicit about it and was extremely angry. But more people were pissed about me using profanity in their presence than they were about the way these kids were bashing our country and bashing our president. No, nobody's, you know, there was one guy in the whole restaurant that put my back on that.
Oh, that's good. At least somebody was there to cover your back. So, But yeah, well, that's the mentality of these people anymore. They don't understand. They don't. They've never been to a communist country. They've never been to a country that's so, you know, ruled by these little despot dictators. They don't understand what it's like.
There's no way for them to comprehend.
Come back and tell me, you know. No, they can't comprehend it. They can't comprehend their cell phones. That they don't got them over there. You know, they can't comprehend all these other things that their freedoms that they take for granted over in this country that they will never have. And that's why
the problem with my generation is most of them are turds like that. They most of them have been spoon fed by their previous generation, which has been a very successful generation. They raised America from. You know, the baby boomer generation has done tremendous things.
Well, Carl, do you think that the people in Afghanistan, Iraq, in those areas, now with Egypt and so on, do you think that they are ready for freedom? Do you think they can handle it? I don't really think they can, but...
And I want to follow up on this, Carl.
They want freedom, you know, but what comes with freedom is accountability, and they are not sophisticated enough or don't care enough, pick one, to take charge of accountability.
Do they understand what it is, though?
I don't know. I really don't think so, because these people have no loyalties. Like, they're not loyal people. I know I was never in Afghanistan, but I was in Iraq twice. And there's no loyalties there.
Carl, this is Michael. I want to, but that's a great segue, actually, Uncle Bing. Because in another chapter in your book, you've got Obama's upside down strategy, and this is something that I wanted to go into, and it ties in to Bing's question, and you might can help us understand this. Now let me preface this with what's happened over the last 2 weeks with that stupid video by that Egyptian American out in California, if it even actually exists. Now we know Benghazi was actually a pre-planned 9/11 attack.
Right. Even though our president won't admit it. But
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
The government might not know it, but...
But and we know that to whatever degree, everywhere else, maybe Yemen, Egypt, wherever, to some degree, the ignorant among those marauding masses really believe it's the video. So
yeah.
With that...
They're looking, you know, and that's a lack of accountability right there. They're looking for a reason for them to hate us.
Exactly. And with that, this goes back to Bing's question. And then I want to back this up with another question about when you say in your book on the first one of the first things he did when he took office was the Apologize to the World tour, speaking about the new beginning. So let me back up just a bit to Bing's question. If these folks are not able to let me say, they're not ready for freedom or liberty if they can't understand the basic principle of free speech, whether we like that video or not. That's a basic human right to have that free speech. Sometimes with freedom means you have to accept things that you hate.
Right.
If they cannot accept this, then they're simply just not ready for liberty.
Right. Well, like, for instance, I hate liberals. No, I just hate them. I hate their ideology, I hate the way they think, I hate what they stand for, but you know what, I encourage them to speak out and speak their piece, because A, it gives me an opportunity to make them seem like even more idiots, but B, it's their right, like you said. Now, the people over there, they reason differently, it's completely different for them. They feel it is their right to not have their religion offended. So,
ooh.
They feel that no matter what country you're in, anywhere, that their religion is so precious and so supreme that nobody can have any critical comments of it.
Which right there in that lays the problem in why they will never be free societies. They'll never move beyond the 14th century.
Right, exactly. That's why they're still living in mud huts, pooping in their hands.
Yep, they're still in the Bronze Age. Now, with that, Carl, I'm going to go back to the book here. In Obama's upside-down strategy, and I'm asking you this because I want to get your opinions. You say one of the first things he did when he took office was to apologize to the world, which everyone knows is the New Beginning speech that he did starting in Cairo. Now, we then subsequently threw Mubarak under the bus. Granted, Mubarak was a brutal dictator, but I'm of the opinion better the devil you know than the devil you don't.
Exactly.
So we threw Mubarak under the bus, who, let me just throw this in here. For all of their goods and bads, and I know that Saddam Hussein was a monster of our own creating and he needed to be taken out. But some of the advantages of a person like a Saddam Hussein or a Mubarak is when you've got people living in the Bronze Age that don't understand basic freedoms, they have to be controlled with a heavy hand.
Exactly. They're not capable of governing themselves. A dictatorship will always fill that void because somebody will always – people won't govern themselves. They won't create the government that we have. They'll just let the void be filled by a dictator.
Exactly. So now we threw Mubarak under the bus for – which I think there's some connections there anyway, but for the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, when that happened, I posted on Facebook and took some flack from some family that thinks that I'm about the most racist, anti-Muslim person walking the face of the earth. I don't know. Maybe I am. But I said, you watch. This is going to have dire consequences. Dire consequences that, yes, they freely elected these people into office, but we allowed Mubarak to get thrown under the bus, and now look what's happening over there.
Yeah.
With Muslim Brotherhood.
That's the way it is. It is what it is. And some people refuse to accept the fact that there is any evil in the world. And it's killing us because these people are – how many of those people that gave you flack were ever in the military?
Yeah, and then you've also got countries that are trying to dictate our policy to us. Hey, you know, don't talk bad about these people. They don't understand freedom themselves. You know, there's people over here that burn the flag. You know, they have the right to do that. There's people over here that put Jesus Christ in a bottle of urine, and I guess they have the right to do that. You don't see people, you don't see Christians running around going out killing people over that. But,
right.
But
if you burn the Bible, pisses me off. But you know,
But you're not going to go out and shoot somebody or target their
family
for it. See, because that's because we have that freedom. I mean, you're a young guy. What are you, 29, I think, now?
Yeah, 29.
I mean, man, you know, I'm 52. I've seen a lot of this stuff just creep. I mean, it seems like every day I almost don't want to get up anymore because it's like, what is going on today, you know? But, you know, you have to keep on keeping on. But the thing is that I'm sitting there going, you know, what other religion do you know? And this ain't religion, it's theocracy. But what other religion do you know that will sit there and kill somebody over expressing freedom of speech?
Right.
I don't know of any other.
Yeah,
it's
funny that this whole thing was started because the people of the religion of peace flew two planes into our tower killing 3,000 people. So, you know, I mean, it's hard to
figure it out.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's like, this goes back to my story in there about me on the playground, you know, with the kids, you know, they'd make fun of you, you'd tell them to stop. They'd keep making fun of you, they'd tell them to stop. Then they'd bully you, you'd tell them to stop. They wouldn't stop, but the second you knocked them out, guess what? They stopped. So America needs to start knocking people out. We've sent enough letters, we've told them enough people, so it's time to start knocking people out.
Oh yeah, that's like also your story about being on the bus or the tarmac. I think it was on in Qatar.
Yeah,
I believe my brother was at the same base, and from what he was telling me was that the CEO of the base was a Qatari, and I don't know whatever you call him. But he came. They had a plane delay. They were coming back to the States, and they said their tour. And he came on the bus, and he was trying to just get people thrown in the clink, you know. So he come up to them with a tire iron, and you know, starting hitting. He's the Air Force, and they start hitting him on the shins. You know, nobody's really said nothing, you know, except ouch. And so he went up to do that to my brother, and my brother got up in his face and yelled at him and told him not to, he better not do that or he'd kill him, you know. And he backed down and ended up going off the bus. And my brother told me at that time, he said, you know, he said, some of these people, if you just yell at them, they understand that. They don't understand apologizing. They don't understand that.
They understand
apologizing to them. Yeah, apologizing to them is a sign of weakness, not a sign of strength.
Right.
And here we got a president that runs around apologizing to everybody.
Exactly. Well, you know, it goes back. Like if Ahmadinejad hates us, which he or does, but if he were to hate us even more, but he were to be afraid of us in that hatred, I'll take that over trying to, you know, build some kind of bond or whatever they're doing right now. You're not going to negotiate with them. They're going to hate us no matter what. We might as well make them scared. Let them hate us. Let them throw darts at a little picture of us in their bedroom. But if they're scared of us, they're going to think twice.
Yeah, and sanctions don't work, man. I don't think it's worked for any country.
No,
sanctions
I tell you what does
work
with bombing them and drilling through the glass.
Yeah, I like that.
So, I mean, like our Admiral McCraven, the four-star admiral in charge of SOCOM, started the Special Operations Command, all special forces. He said, we cannot kill our way to victory in this war, and I challenge that. Because if you have enemies and you eliminate enemies, you have no more enemies, hence you have won the war. That's what we did in World War II, and we gained the respect of the planet.
Right.
Well,
the same thing with the Cold War. We threatened the Russians. And the Russians,
I don't know what war college he went to, but, you know.
Carl, in another part of your book, and this kind of stuck out to me as a veteran, insofar as what I do now is, you know, I call myself a conservative info pusher. That's what being and I and our circles do now is we push conservative message on behalf of candidates. And we have a lot of friends that are not veterans. And you know, I get the thank you for your service and all of that. And sometimes it makes me feel kind of funny. I was a peacetime soldier. I served under Ronald Reagan, greatest president in my lifetime, probably ever. And we had a little incident down on an island called Grenada. It was important in that they had an airstrip down there, and they sent my brigade down, and we did away with that. But anyway, nothing major. It was nothing big at all. But you know, unlike someone who's done what you've done, and the boys and girls that have been over there, and really, you know, have really seen a lot of stuff. But I always thank people, and I always make it a point to thank the people that I work with that are doing what they're doing now. You said in the book, you made, let's see here if I can read my handwriting. You made the analogy that said that Americans like to be cowboys. You give them a rope, and they think they're a cowboy until it comes time to have to lasso the cow. So you were making the analogy of actually acting upon doing something, which you've done,
right.
You've proven. And where I'm going with this is to those folks who've not served, but there's so many thousands of friends that I have in my circles that push information that I ask them to push to help in this fight. And I tell them every day, you may not have worn a uniform like I did or like Carl did, but you're wearing the uniform of America now and you're fighting. And that is just as important. What would you say to those people, Carl?
I'd say thank you. I mean, it takes a lot of courage to speak out and do and, you know, really act on the way you feel. And if you're getting out there, if you're, you know, pushing radio broadcast, or even if you're the greeter at Walmart who sees somebody buying ho-hos with food stamps and you say something, you're a hero. You're looking out for America. You're looking out for my kids and my grandkids, and that's admirable. It does take a lot, and I really appreciate people who do that, because we're going to need a lot of them coming up here real soon.
Oh, we are. We really are. I mean, Carl, I'm afraid that we're – let me get your thoughts on something. You know, we talk about this from week to week. You know, I'm 50, And it seems like every I'm a couple of years younger than my brother from another mother here. And
All right.
It seems like every 10 years we get yanked really far to the left, and then we conservatives will rear up, we'll fight, we'll pull it back just a little bit. But we've already been yanked 180 degrees over to the left. We'll pull it back 90 degrees. So we're 90 degrees further along down the road of liberalism than we were.
Right.
And it keeps happening.
That's the problem. And I really fear that if we reelect Obama, that we are going to see irreparable damage to this country, just fiscally alone, but among other things. I think it's just going to be, I think we will pass the point of no return if we reelect him.
I really feel, if for no other reason, with other presidents, they come and go, we can recover. But here's the problem. We've got about 2 to 4 justices that are due to retire. And if this man gets reelected and puts in, now a couple of those are liberal judges, but I think 1 or 2 might be conservative judges. We're already a 5-4 court. If this scale tips to the left in SCOTUS, we're screwed for several generations.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I mean,
we could be up a creek without a paddle.
We can recover from a bad Congress. We can recover pretty quickly from a bad president. Supreme Court justices have a lifetime appointment. It will take generations to repair the damage that they cause.
Yeah, it would. And even if the Supreme Court, upholding the health care mandate and things like that, but it really is the policies and the spending that it's gonna get it bite us in the long run, because we're selling our children's future to places like China, and it comes a point where the debt and just the interest payments alone will be unsustainable, and that's the biggest thing. And then you end up with Greece.
Yeah, which we're almost there. There's a part in the book where you talk about voting. Now, were you in Iraq when they actually did the voting over there, Carl?
No, I wasn't. I was in Virginia.
Okay. But obviously you were there shortly after, and you know about the blue fingers and everything.
Yeah.
And as a veteran, it kind of disgusts me that we have approximately 50% of our population, which is apathetic. I've stood out in front of Cowboy Stadium and in the ballpark over in Arlington pushing before our runoff at the end of July for Ted Cruz. And you wouldn't believe the snide remarks I would get about just what a lot of people think about how good voting is. Having been over in Iraq and seen some of these, I mean, there's obviously good people in Iraq that really, truly are looking for a better life.
Yes, there are. They still don't reason like us, and they don't have the comprehension as the American system has. But I genuinely believe that there are some people that want a better life there.
And for them to go through what they went through to get the opportunity to vote, something that you fought for on their behalf.
Yeah.
To come home and to have so many people that don't exercise that right. Tell us a little bit.
Or exercise it, based on the whim of a pack of cigarettes from Acorn or something like that. When I see people being persuaded to vote for somebody, or something, that maybe, choosing to vote for somebody because of a factor that's, not akin to their governing style, it's like, do you understand how important that is? I mean, that is something that countless people have died for throughout history, to provide that right. And you're going to throw it away because someone promises something, People who voted for Obama were in the streets saying, now I don't have to pay my mortgage. I don't have to put gas in my car. Like, they're going to do it. Why are these people allowed to vote? Why is their vote worth as much as people who are educated? That bothers me. And, we can't discredit people's voting. We can't say, oh, you don't know enough, you're not voting. But we need to instill that accountability to say, if you don't know what you're voting for, don't vote.
Yeah, the most sacred right that we have as Americans. And people just I don't know if you call it abuse. I guess you could. I think it's just ignorance, plain doggone ignorance. They just don't they want, I guess, what they think they're entitled to. And it's the entitlement mentality is what we've gotten into. And as Michael was saying, yeah, you know, every 10 years we take, you know, two steps back, and then, you know, we only gain about one step forward. And that's what really goes on, you know. So we keep ending up in a hole until somebody takes the reins of the horse and takes the blinders off and can actually ride that horse.
Yeah, well,
and make it go in the direction that it needs to go.
Right. It's going to come a point where they don't, where we don't have any more money to give, where we can't provide anymore. And then they're going to be like, oh, why can't you provide my, you know, why can't you feed my kids? Why can't you insure me? Things like that. Why? Because we spent all this money before doing it when you could have gone out and gotten a job and contributed.
Yeah, I mean, where do the entitlements stop? You know, I mean, is it, you know, do they stop at just providing food? No, I mean, next, well, it's already cell phones. You know, they got a government program to provide cell phones to people, to provide high-speed internet. I mean, next is going to be to, you know, provide cars. I mean, it's just never going to stop. And when they get 50% of the populace or more of the voting people out there that actually do vote on their side, then the game's over, in my opinion. That's just my opinion.
I think you should have, you know, on those food stamp cards or whatever, the cash cards or whatever they give you, there should be a very, very, very short list of things you can buy. You can, you know, fish, chicken, bread, water.
The essentials that you need to survive. You shouldn't be able to buy ho-hos. You know, in some states with the EBT card, in fact, there was a lady up in your neck of the woods, Carl, not too long ago, or a guy, I want to say in New Hampshire maybe. I could Google it, but I'm not going to. Y'all just have to trust me. That lost his job for refusing to sell a pack of cigarettes to someone with an EBT card.
Yeah.
Now, if this is not... I'm going to temper my language. If this is not a screwed up situation where we're not only are we going to look, we're conservatives. We believe that there needs to be a security net to some degree for a small length of time to help our fellow man and woman get on their feet when they hit hard times. Got no problem with that.
Right, but it needs to have consequences to it as well, and it needs to have incentive to not want to be on it, such as what I talk about in my book. If you receive entitlements during any set election, during any set term, you do not get to vote at the subsequent election, because if you elect to receive benefits, you would be electing to forego that right to vote.
Yeah, you know, I've never thought about that. You've got a vested interest in getting someone in there who's bribing you with more freebies.
Exactly.
Well, that's what I was saying. When you got 50% of the people or more that are they're you know on welfare, then the game is over, guys. You know.
Well, we've made it so easy. You know, we now have
shame involved in it anymore. People and they take advantage. They know exactly how the game is played. They know exactly how much money they need to make a year just to survive, and they don't get married, and they have 3, 5, 6 kids, and they all get money from them. You know, and I've seen them here. You know, they just call up and say, how much money did I make this year? You know, and then they'll stop working. They'll take a month off or a couple of weeks or whatever, you know, just to keep that money down so that they get more when they get their taxes back.
Well, here's another thing that would save the government millions of dollars. If you deducted money from their welfare check every time they had a child, it would save us millions and billions, billions of dollars, because people would, A, either get off welfare because they're like, oh man, I have 9 kids and I am getting, you know, $17 a month in welfare check, or hey, I want to have kids, you know, but I'm getting welfare, and if I have one, it's not a good idea to have a child if you can't provide for it. That's what that'll instill.
Right. Well, exactly.
The government should have the food stamp offices in the same grocery store where they sell the food. You know, and these teachers that are striking and so on, I mean, they ought to take and say, okay, we're going to put that tax as an itemized deduction in everybody's paycheck so that they know. We've become disconnected from the cost of medicine. We've been become disconnected from where our taxes go. We just pay them and they go somewhere. We don't know where they go for. But if that was itemized out, I think people would freak out. They would sit there and go, why am I paying for these teachers' pensions, man? Why am I paying this much? Why am I paying for welfare and so on? Do you see what I'm saying?
When you have a system that does away with the actual food stamp that you had to stand at the counter with, which was probably very embarrassing to use, when they do away with something like that in exchange for an EBT card, we call them Lone Star cards here in Texas, solely for the reason so that that person is not embarrassed, then you've taken away one of the reasons that gives them incentive to get off of it. Embarrassment, shame. Shame for being on it. Now, look, is there times in people's lives when they need to be on them? Yes, sure there is, and there should be no shame in that. If you've got a plan, you've got a system, you're working to get off of them, and what you're going to end up doing in 2 years is going to more than compensate what you took from the taxpayers. But that's not the case. That's not the case with about 40%. I'm sorry, with about 25 to 30% of the 47% that Mitt Romney was talking about. They're freeloaders. Right. Plain and simple, they're freeloaders.
Yep.
And they've
come across these people before, and I've seen it, and it's nauseating. They don't care. They have no aspirations to get off of it. They're happy just collecting a check, and they don't care where it comes from because they've never had to work for it.
And they get back money at the end of the year.
That
freaks me out. I know a family up here, she got about 4 or 5 kids. She gets back about 10 grand, 12 grand a year. Earned income credit, child tax credit. I mean, you name it. They built the system. They know exactly how to do it. They're actually probably, if they needed to, they could probably get a job as a CPA and do very good.
Well, that's another thing, too, is I've sat there in an emergency room with my wife before. Now, got out of the military, we pay $2,500 every 3 months for our health insurance because she's pregnant and for the, me and the 1.5 of her. So we've gone to the ER when she needed something. She was having, a medical issue. And so we went in there, we checked in. We watched some of these people who were, admittingly on Medicaid come in, complain of chest pains and trouble breathing. They know that's the ticket. And they were seen first before us, and all they had was a cold. But they say chest pains and trouble breathing. So they get in there first, they get their medication for free, and they get out.
It's the whole, what's in it for me type of mentality anymore. There, like you said, there's no accountability. There's no personal responsibility or pride. There's no pride. I mean, we used to go to the grocery store when I was a kid and see people using food stamps and so on. And, they look shameful, and I'd talk to my mom about it and she'd tell me what was going on or whatever, and I felt sorry for them. We are a very compassionate society, sometimes to the point of over-compassionate. And with that, we can be compassionate and still have some kind of semblance of morality or what's right or what's wrong,
But that's the thing. They're bleeding the morality out of society today, and that's one of the programs they're doing it with.
We are a very compassionate society. Carl here is a fine example of it, as well as a gentleman that's just called in that'd like to speak to you here in a minute, Carl. Bob, he's former Marine. But we've got men and women that will go and give blood for other countries. So, yes, we are a very compassionate country.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, we're at the top of the hour. I need to do a quick PSA. Carl, I am a big supporter of Wounded Warrior Project. And as a courtesy to them, I do a PSA on my show every week. So I'd like to do that. And then coming out of the top of the hour, if you have time, we've got a few calls. I've got some more questions, but I'd like to get. There's some folks that want to say hi and thank you or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to.
Okay. Folks, 718-305-7176. Give us a call. The phone lines are starting to call in now. We're going to do a quick PSA, and I'll be right back to you.
for a medic went out, Alan left a covered position to run to render aid. That was when he was hit.
The bullet struck him on the right side between his body armor.
Say a prayer for peace.
Alan was one of the first wounded warriors to come out of Iraq in 2003. I'm Trace Adkins, and I want to tell you about Wounded Warrior Project and how they helped this brave young man and his family.
There was life in his eyes, but everything else was non-responsive.
The doctors anticipated that Alan would be bedridden and need to be spoon-fed for the rest of his life.
The job of helping wounded warriors rebuild their lives is massive and growing every day. Your gift of just $19 a month will help wounded warriors like Alan, who refuse to give up.
I'm in the fields of Vietnam, the mountains of Afghanistan.
Alan earned the Purple Heart and the Bronze Star for his actions on the battlefield. He is a true American hero. But Alan became my hero for the battle he fought day after day after day to get his life back.
Your call today and a gift of $19 a month can help provide our wounded warriors with desperately needed programs and services through Wounded Warrior Project.
I would encourage you to donate to the Wounded Warrior Project.
It's going to take a lot of us for a long time to help these young men and women.
Call or go online with a pledge of $19 a month and you'll receive this Wounded Warrior Project blanket.
Wounded Warrior Project, all I can really say is thank you. Thank you for being there and giving me something to achieve.
Say a prayer for peace.
Hi, this is Rich Lowry, co-author of the 999 Plan, and you're listening to Michael B. Smith and the Soldiers of Patriotism.
Thank you very much, Rich. Brother Bing, that's old Rich Lowry, co-author of the 999 Plan. Folks, we've got Carl Higbee on with us today, former Navy SEAL and author of Battle on the Home Front. Guys and ladies, I encourage you to go to Carl's website, which I've got right here, but my website address is not in there for some reason. It's
battleonthehomefront.com.
Okay. And I purchased the book on Amazon.com. I did the download. I didn't buy the hard copy, which is surprising. I'm a tactile kind of guy, but I'm going to start trying to read. Actually, I'm going to start trying to listen to books, Carl. But I bought yours on my Kindle app. First time I've ever bought a book on Kindle. So I just want to thank you again for joining us today, Carl. We've got a couple of folks on the line with us here. I want to bring in first our brother from Tennessee, Kurt, and then after Kurt, we'll go ahead and we'll bring on Bob, and just we'll kind of round table, let these guys ask some questions of you. I'm sure we'll get some other calls coming in. I've got a few more questions for you myself, Carl. Bob or Kurt, go ahead.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Hey, Kurt, how you doing?
I'm doing good, and if I may, I'd like to call you sir. I'm 76 years old.
I'm a working man.
I know that, but I'm 76 years old, and any man that's been where you have been to me is sir, okay? And we got that out of the way. I don't know if you're in a position to answer this question or not, or even if you might be allowed to answer it, but there's been a lot of flap going on online. In blogs, et cetera, about the Marines at the embassy in Libya, I believe it was, and there may have been some other places indicated in that those Marines were not issued or were not allowed to have live ammo. Are you in a position to be able to address that?
Well, I can't say for sure because I don't know whether or not they were issued or had or any live ammo. I can tell you similar situations that I have encountered, and I talk about it in the book. At the outer gates at Iraq, the Marines were not allowed. They had bullets, but they weren't allowed to keep their weapons loaded, which is pretty much a standard operating procedure for a lot of the Marine battalions, and it's destroying it because That's like having a car in your driveway with no gas in it. Why would you not have bullets in your gun ready to use? And why would your commanding officer not authorize you to use those bullets to defend our post, our land?
That concept of not being armed with live ammunition is inconscionable to me. But anyway,
right.
Thank you for your service.
Kurt, thank you very much for taking time.
Stand by, Kurt. I'm going to leave you on hot. Carl, before I bring Bob on here, speaking of Benghazi, and I don't know if to what anything you can address about this, we all know that you lost a brother over there that was working for Blackwater. Was his name Glenn Doherty?
It's not called Blackwater anymore and everything like that. I don't like to talk about, you know, what happened with them on the radio or anything like that. It's unfortunate is what it is.
Okay, understood. With that, let's go ahead. Bob, come on in here. Let's speak to Carl.
Hey guys, thanks for.
Bob, tell us a little bit about yourself, Bob.
Well, I'm a former Marine a long time ago. I mean, back in the 80s is when I served, and, you know, I still actually started a nonprofit to try and help maintain it's a small nonprofit, troop morale, to maintain troop morale, stuff like that. We play, like, music at, like, military hospitals and stuff like that. We played at Walter Reed. So I still care about the vets and our younger guys that have served because, you know, I see, like, the older guys, older than me, some of my best buddies are Vietnam vets, and they never got the welcome home. So, you know, there's a good number of us, like my age or whatever, that want to make sure that the younger guys don't ever get that same treatment again. So, but I just wanted to call and thank you guys for your service and everything. And what the guy was saying about the not being able to have loaded weapons when you're on guard duty is just one of the reasons that I can't in any good conscience actually recommend any youth going in to serve this country right now under this regime. I mean, it's just incredible. You can put a man in harm's way and no way to defend himself. It's just beyond.
You're absolutely right. And the thing, too, is when I wrote that in my book, I was told by my commanding officer, you can't say that. And I asked him, why not, sir? Well, it just makes us look bad. I said, well, don't get mad at me. Change the policy. Don't get mad at me for saying what it is.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's immensely frustrating. Here, these young kids are hanging it out, and they're not allowed to do anything.
Is it things like that, along with some other Carl that made it difficult for you to get approval to get your book published?
Well, first off, it was never actually officially approved. I submitted it 2 years prior to any and all agency in the military, DOD, NCIS, whatever, to try to get approved, and nobody would look at it. Somebody from NCIS actually looked at it and says, I can't give you an official approval because it's got to come from your command, but I don't see anything classified in here, which is all I was really looking for. And I have that email, I saved that, and they tried to tell me that I never got it approved anyway. And it's like, well, I gave it to you 2 years prior to publication, and you never approved it. So that was one of the things they hit me on in there. They were like, well, you're endangering our troops. I was like, we're out of Iraq when the book was published. I was like, so how am I endangering our troops in Iraq? You know, I mean, it was a nightmare. They just didn't want it. They hoped if they ignored it, I would just go away. And, you know, from the way they trained me as a SEAL, why would they think that I would quit, you know?
Somehow or another, you don't strike me as someone that's going to go away, Carl. In fact, I was just sitting here listening to you answer Bob's question. Bob, you're still with us, Bob, so hang tight, buddy. And I thought to myself, my God, now, is this captain that he's talking to, or whomever this officer is he another SEAL, or is he just an officer in the Navy? Oh, so, okay. So, yeah, because I'm thinking to myself, man, I just don't know if I want this cocky young man that's been through SEAL training that can whoop my ass with one arm tied behind his back, and I'm going to piss him off, you know. But in reading the book, I really didn't see anything in there myself that I would have even thought was questionable for them to even be questioning on. I mean, the book doesn't read that way to me.
Right, and it's specifically designed to be that way. And, you know, the book's not about me. It's not about my missions. It's not about – it's about what's wrong with what's going on. And,
exactly.
Yeah, I reference overseas, but it is a passion I have. First and foremost, I care about our brothers and sisters coming home, and I can guarantee you – I can't name a specific time that I had, but I can guarantee you – our politics have cost lives,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I can't say whether or not they had bullets at the embassy or anything like that, but I can guarantee you that there's been multiple deaths. Actually, you know what? I do have an example. We had an EOD guy died right before his 23rd birthday. He's a EOD is the bomb guy.
I was going to say you might need to elaborate on EOD for the. They may not understand the nomenclature.
They're the guys, if you see them running, try to keep up. but this guy, you know, he defused bombs and things like that, and he was deployed with us and things. Well, he was told to go out and clear this route. So he went and cleared this route in Iraq. It was a road, and making sure there's no IEDs. Well, they found an IED. They said, well, we want to blow this thing in place. And they want to put an explosive charge on it and destroy it where it stands. So they don't have to move it. They don't have to risk anyone's lives. Well, the headquarters and the rules of engagement said, no, you have to remove it from the ground, put it in a trailer, and bring it back to an area that won't disturb the local Iraqi people if we blow it up. So, like a good soldier, he went over there and he did that. He did all the standard procedures on how to disarm it and everything like that. Well, he picked it up and it was booby-trapped and he died because he was trying to follow the rules of engagement that were set forth by politicians who most of them have never hung their butt out there like that. And it makes me want to throw up because, you know what, sorry the Iraqi people have to hear a boom, but guess what? That kid's not coming home now.
Well, it's the same thing, too, with in Afghanistan with them training the Afghanis or letting them in, I guess, and then giving them a gun and then turning around and shooting our own soldiers.
Well, I got a ton of heat in the World Daily News the other day, and I was on a couple of radio programs. So I called General Dempsey a moron. And I said, people were like, oh, my God, you can't call him a moron. He's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I said, well, he is a moron, and here's why. It took over 50 deaths of Americans killed by coalition forces in uniform, most of them armed with weapons we gave them. It took 50 U.S. deaths in that manner for them to even think about reconsidering the policy in which we train these soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, I would have said, we're done training. We're done training you. That's it. We're out.
I wanted to ask, all three of you, Michael, and Carl, and Bob, do you think we accomplished our mission there? Do you think it's time to get out, really?
In Afghanistan?
First off, what is the mission? What is the mission?
That's what I'm trying to get to. I don't think we have a clear defined mission.
We never went in there. I mean, we went in there under the preface of WMDs, but what are we doing now? We're nation building. Why are we nation? Our country is in shambles. Why are we nation building a medieval, you know, barely educated country that doesn't like us anyway? Either fight to win or come home.
Right. That's what I agree to. And like I alluded earlier, they don't understand freedom. They don't get it. I don't think they're ready for it.
Well, here's the thing.
It shouldn't be our expense to give it to them.
Right.
Bean, that was a great segue to a part of your book, Carl, that I wanted to touch on. But let me first answer your question. I don't think that we're say the question again that you had, Bean. That you want
to do you think it's time that, I mean, has our mission really, do we have a defined mission? Have we accomplished it? Is it time to get out?
I mean, and here's the problem, and here's the way I would answer it. And Carl alluded to this earlier with the college students in the bread place. And, you know, we as a country, as Americans, we've got fighting us for about 4 or 5 years. We're fighting people that will fight us for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
Now, Carl, in your book, and this is a great segue into that, and Bob, if you think of anything on this, just chime in, buddy.
You say that wars would be fought to win. There would be need to be a definition of victory prior to engaging, not just stability of the region. How would Carl Higbee define victory either in Iraq or Afghanistan or in the Middle East in general, Carl?
If I was called to be the new chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff right now, I would say, okay, sit down. What is our goal? Afghanistan, what do you want from us? If they didn't have an answer, I would just leave. I would say, look, here's the problem. You are harboring terrorists. So we're going to assist you. We're going to train you. We'll aid you to clean this problem up. If you don't, and I'll give them a set amount of time, 6 months, a year, whatever seems reasonable based on local intelligence, and say, if you don't, I'm going to hold your entire country accountable. You know, you've got to think about it. If there was a stadium full of people, say 50,000 people in a stadium, and you knew in that stadium there was one person in there that could potentially destroy the world as we know it, would you bomb that stadium?
Yeah, in a heartbeat.
It's a tough decision. Let's say it was Yankee Stadium, and you got 50,000 people in there, but one person in there will definitely bring this nation to its knees. It would be a heartfelt decision, but I would say yes. You got to get rid of it. And it's the same way with the nation. There's a lot of people in there that are fully content, you know, herding goats the rest of their lives, and they will never affect America. They don't like the fact that we're there, and they may fight us while we're there, but they don't have the capacity or they don't have the desire to come into this country and fight us. But there are people there that do. There are people there that will affect America and kill thousands of Americans if it goes unchecked. And we will say, seek them out and get rid of them, and we will help you. If you turn down our help or if you complain about how we're doing things, guess what? It's us versus you as a country.
Well, and
that,
you know,
that's where liberalism is so bipolar or opposite. It's 180 degrees twisted because, you know, if they had a guy that was here that knew about a plan to dirty bomb, whatever it might be, that would kill millions of people, and they sat there and we've got so, you know, they don't want to waterboard the guy. They don't want to do whatever they can to get that information out. If it was me,
yeah,
I would do whatever it takes to get that information out of these people because
That's
they
true.
Don't understand anything other than that. And if they're in here and know that information and they want to kill us, then by God, we ought to sit there and bring it back to them.
Yeah. If Iran gets a nuke, what do you think they're going to do with it? They're going to hit Israel.
Like I said earlier, we got Netanyahu wants to meet with the president. You know, look, these people are probably 30, 40 days away from striking Iran. I mean, that's my opinion. And I don't think it's going to be no piece of cake, but this president doesn't. I mean, is there some big disconnect? Do you honestly feel, as a retired SEAL, do you honestly think that this administration just really don't give a rat's ass about you?
Yeah, I get that feeling. I mean, we need to stop worrying about who's offended and start worrying about who's affected. You know,
right.
We're not caring if people are upset with Americans going invading a country. Guess what? We could clean house in Afghanistan in less than a year if we really put our assets to it and we fought the way we needed to fight on our terms.
Here's what we're seeing with the last couple of weeks in Egypt, in Libya, and all over the place. This is very similar to when the Russians left Afghanistan at the beginning of the 90s. We've given dates certain. We're starting to see it now. We saw it in the Sudan and Ethiopia when the Cold War was over. What you're seeing now, that's this sound right here. That's America disengaging. And that's what you get when we disengage, is you get chaos in a chaotic part of the world that is going to have to be controlled somehow or another. Am I wrong, Carl?
No, you're absolutely right. And the thing is, I think the GDP of Afghanistan is in a ballpark $15 billion a year. Well, foreign aid is $200 billion a year. So when we pull out, you're going to have a vacuum of support. They will not. They are unsustainable as is.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, guys, I got to step away and go into the front door. Being taken for a few minutes. You and Carl and Bob and Kurt.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, no problem. Yeah, despite your family background, I mean, you know, you have a wife, obviously, kids.
Right.
You're 29 years old, man. It's like, you know, you're really an American idol. You know, I don't want to, you know, use those terms, but I mean, you know, you're a patriot. You're somebody that people can look up to. I mean, what do you got planned for the rest of your life? Have you thought about it?
I mean
you wrote a great book. I mean,
I've gotten that one. I got another book coming out probably in the next 5 months here, and it's more of a detailed solution based book, and I'm co-authoring it with a Navy JAG, the guy who wrote the foreword. And I hate to say it because I hate politics, but I feel like I got to get in there. I mean, I don't want
definitely.
To, and my wife is threatening to leave me if I run for office. But I'm serious. I told her, I said, you know, I was up in Pittsburgh this morning. I rode my Harley back down from Pittsburgh today. But I was meeting with a couple people up there to get some information on running for office, and it pains me, and it's something I never wanted to do, but I feel like it's the only way to affect something. You just need to go in there and start a fire on Capitol Hill. Metaphorically.
What office would you like to run for?
I've been told that I'm going to start at state Senate, the state Senate level, but I've been told Senate is the way I need to go.
Right. I was, you know, helped out on three campaigns, Mr. Keynes, Santorum's, and a local campaign here with Zach Poskowitz running for Senate from Tennessee, but for U.S. Senate. And I got to tell you, I think I would start out, you know, at the state level instead of.
I can't go from zero to hero overnight.
Yeah, and if you need any pointers, man, I can hook you up with Zach, and I'm sure he'll tell you what you need to do. He's ex-military and all that stuff, and he, you know, the guy who just speaks, he's been on our show before and a couple times, and you know, good friend, and he can give you some pointers.
Yeah. I mean, I got a lot of battle ahead of me, and going back to that, I don't see myself as this, you know, as any hero or, you know, super American or anything. That I see myself as a normal guy that's paying my dues. We borrowed this country from some of the greatest men that's ever walked this earth, and we owe it to them. I'm not special. I'm not doing anything extraordinary. I'm doing what I feel is owed to our founding fathers and to our children.
Yeah, and what you're doing off the battlefield is to me is almost as important, if not more so, than what you did on the battlefield. It's just, you know, we have to wake people up, man. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at, I don't trust polls anyways, but I'm sitting here looking at these polls. I'm looking at, you know, I mean, I can't believe 40 that is tied 46-46. I mean, I'm looking back at the 80s and so on, and I'm thinking, okay, it was 8 points. Carter was ahead by Reagan, and Reagan ended up winning by 10. So I don't sit there and trust the polls.
No, polls are polls. That's what they are.
But I do know that when you get a certain amount of people that, you know, are dependent on the government, then, you know, it's time to change something. It's time to do something different.
Well, I want to hand the Darwin Award to the American people for even considering to reelect Barack Obama because – I mean, Mitt Romney, I'm going to be honest, he wasn't my first choice. I was a Gingrich fan. This Gingrich is he tells it how it is. He walks a straight line. He's, to be honest, he's a hardliner, and he's kind of a rude dude, but I think he's what we needed for the job. But now we got Romney. This guy has succeeded in everything he's ever done, including turn the Olympics into a surplus of money. It's always been a deficit program, but he turned it into a bet. He ran as a Republican in the most liberal state in the United States and then turned a deficit into a surplus. He revolutionized, you know, according to a lot of people, he revolutionized private equity in America. And this guy, he has, and people say he's not compassionate. He shut down his company when one of his employees' daughters was taken. He shut down the whole company and used personal assets to help find this girl. So he's a compassionate guy. He's what we need right now. And why can't people see that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think they do. I keep telling my friends and everybody here and all that. I think this is going to be almost a landslide. That's what
I
think.
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. It's going to be very close.
I think everything that with the gas prices up, and we still got, you know, we still got four or five weeks left, and with the debate not even on yet, and with housing and so on, unemployment down, you got more people just not even looking anymore because there's no jobs out there. This is reminds me of Carter and Reagan, and I'm just, I don't know. Maybe I'm, you know, playing some kind of foolish, childish game in my mind, but I think it's going to be a blowout. That's what I'm sticking to that too.
Bing, I keep
so
telling myself the same thing because we
know. Go ahead, Michael.
I was going to say I want to feel the same way as you. I mean, I'm like Carl, and I guess I'm prepared for a close victory, maybe even a close loss, because I have so much distrust in so many of our fellow Americans anymore to do the right thing. But I do know from having studied it that the polls that we're seeing and are being reflected to us in the news are oversampled 6-1 Democrat to Republican, and they're registered voters, not likely voters. So we're not getting an accurate snapshot. Now, maybe I'm biased because my circle is so active that it seems to me like it's going to be a landslide. But I got to tell you, this is the weirdest election cycle in all of them.
This will redefine America.
Yeah.
Well, and there's another reason why I look at this, you know, with the Wisconsin recall, you know, vote going the opposite way. And look, that you had to have Chris Matthews over there just peeing down his leg. I mean, the guy, they couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe that it went the other way. You've got, you know, of course, we got the unions up in Chi-Town up there, you know, in Illinois. But the thing is that I think there's a different direction. I think there's a different mentality. I really want to hope that way. I want to be optimistic. I don't want to be pessimistic because I'll get myself down and I'll go out and have to shoot my gun and waste a bunch of rounds. Okay, but I mean, I want to be optimistic, you know. And I think, and you know, maybe landslide is a little bit too much to ask for, but I think it's not going to be a tie. I don't know.
Well, here's the thing: is Romney's an awkward guy. He's not a personable guy, and people, you know, people who don't follow politics, they see Obama's a charismatic dude. People like that, and so a lot of people are going to vote based on that. And it's sickening, but that's the facts.
Well,
yeah,
it might be true with that, but
Bob, go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, what I was going to say is what you're talking about here in general is this huge psychological warfare has been propagated by the media in this country. It's basically so deeply infiltrated by let's be clear what they really are. These are propaganda operatives that Pravda would be proud of. You know what I'm saying? And these people are unabashed liberals, and the liberal editor of the liberal newspaper Seattle Times even admitted as much back when Karl Rove was giving his resignation speech, when people in his own newsroom were cheering the announcement. These are supposed to be ethical professionals. He had to castigate his own reporters, and he admitted at the time that one of the main reasons driving influences for people to get into quote-unquote journalism, and I use that term very loosely, was for the purposes of activism. So what we're seeing is activist psychological warfare being propagated, and you mentioned earlier, one of you guys mentioned earlier, that they need the uninformed voter, who only gets a little snippet. You know, they see the charismatic Obama. They see maybe Romney stumbling here and there. And, of course, these operatives in the media are going to play up the negatives of Romney and make Obama look as good as possible. They're not going to report the jobs. They're not going to report the gasoline prices like you guys were mentioning earlier, all that stuff we've been talking about. And so it's important to remember that these uninformed voters are getting just that little snippet that these propaganda operatives want them to get. So we are up against a huge, huge psychological war warfare going against us here. We've got to. I don't know what all the answers are. I'm just a simple man, but it's crystal clear what's happening here to me. And
Bob, don't ever forget, being a simple man's a great thing, Bob.
Yep. Yeah, because your mind is not clouded by obfuscations and everything. You can see a little bit more clearly, I think.
Yeah,
and unfortunately what happens is you guys also were talking earlier about entitlements, you know, food stamps, welfare, cell phones being given away. Here in Maryland, food stamps cards that they give to poor people here, guess what they call it? They call it the independence card. You know what I mean? And it's basically an insidious, the bottom line result of the whole thing is that, I hate to say this, but conservatives are basically, we're financing our own demise. Because I've never seen any study on who pays more taxes between conservatives and liberals, but I'm willing to bet every last penny that I own, which isn't a lot, that it's conservatives paying most of the taxes in this country. Because we're the ones going to work. Their constituency is on welfare and food stamps. They're not going to work. They're not paying taxes.
Yeah, but then the liberal left Hollywood. I mean, Michael Moore's, you know, and places like that, you know, they're driving their hybrids around giving millions of dollars to Obama.
Right, right. That's another great example of it too, because again, look, this propaganda thing, this psychological warfare. Nobody is saying is this. Michael Moore, Ted Turner, you know, Al Gore. There's a whole we got a mountain list of these Learjet liberals that have used how did they get rich? They did it in America using capitalism, which thereby proves that capitalism actually works. But yet,
yeah,
when they got theirs, they want to turn around and force socialism on the rest of us.
You're
never
absolutely
were.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you got guys like Charlie Rangel. This guy is in charge of defining how our tax system works. He's on the board. I mean, he's the chairman of the board of that. But yet he, you know, dodged taxes on his rental properties and, you know, stuff like that. So it's like it's a very smoke and mirrors. Do as I say, not as I do. And it's like, what? You know, I don't know. I mean, it drives me up a wall. But
thing is that we got people like you and people like Matt Bissonnette, and we got other people. There's movies out. We got Atlas Shrugged coming out. We got the one you seen, Michael, that you said was really good. I mean, there's a lot of conservative movies and books and things that are coming out, and I hope people get to read them. And, you know, Carl, feel free, man, all the time to plug your website where they can get the book.
Yeah, battleonthehomefront.com. Check it out.
And you folks, you've got to read the book. It's 140. I'm telling you, it's a great read. Get it, download it, buy the book. It's a great book. You'll really enjoy it. We're starting to wind down here to the end of the show, Carl. I want to thank you again for coming on. But before we get into all the thank yous and everything, I want to give you just whatever amount of time you need to go on a rant, a diatribe, whatever, say what you want to say, promote your website, take whatever time you need. This is the part of the show where I like for our guests to be able to have some uninterrupted time just to vent.
Well, I think I've been venting this whole time. I mean, you see me getting pretty irritated with some of the issues that we're facing, but I've gotten pretty much all I need to get out, you know, Romney 2012, I guess.
Well, Carl, it's been an honor, really, to have you on, sir. Let me just run through the guest here. We're going to start with Bing, and then Bob, you're on deck, and then Kurt. And say what you need to say. If you've got a question or two for Carl before the show ends, get it in now or whatever. Go ahead, Bing.
I was just going to say again, man, thank you so much for your service, for the book you're about to read or write, and for everything you're about to do. You're a young guy, man. You know, you got a lot. And if you're going to run for Senate, then you got my vote if I lived in your state. So,
well, you've got just keep us in your Rolodex.
Yeah, and anything that, you know, we can do to help you. And, you know, you can also check out our site over there, traditionalamericanmovement.com. We're a bunch of conservatives, and we totally agree with what, you know, with your mission, I guess, is what you chose to take it on. And whether you like it or not. And the thing is that I just, you know, hope everybody goes out there and gets your book and reads it and gets informed.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I hope they do, too.
Bob?
Yeah, yeah, just, you know, from one veteran to another, thank you very much for your service. All you guys who've served actually here, and if you do decide to run for politics, just remember a good friend of mine named Pat Dollard, I don't know if you're familiar with him at all, but he basically calls politics war by another name. So you are still serving your country right now by writing your book, coming on shows like this. You know, I mean, this is the common folk where we get to talk. We get to, you know, express ourselves, First Amendment and all that good stuff. And this is the real grassroots. And you know, keep your stiff upper lip. And, you know, there's a bunch of us out here that are behind you. And, you know, we really are proud of what you're doing. And just always keep that in mind, man. And, you know, and just keep rocking. This country is worth fighting for, no doubt about it.
I appreciate the support, man, because there's definitely some times where I'm like, get a little overwhelmed with all the crap that's being thrown at me. So, but I appreciate the support, and I'm not going to quit.
Hoorah. Kurt, any parting words for Carl?
Again, thank you, Carl, for your service. At some point in time, I'm going to communicate with you through what I consider a more secure medium. I have a question I want to ask you about a book, which I will not even call the name of it here. I want to know if you've read it, and if you have, I want to know what you think about it. Anyway, you have a great rest of the day, and look forward to communicating with you later, okay?
Right on. You can hit me on Facebook, actually. Look for Carl Higbee.
I'm not going to put it on Facebook.
No, friend him on Facebook and send him a PM, Kurt.
Okay.
All right, hang tight for the end of the show, guys. Carl, I just want to say hang tight, Bing. First of all, I wanted to ask you, aside from the book tours and everything, what are you seeing in your future? Bing kind of alluded to this. Do you see a possible congressional run of any type in your future, or?
Definitely. I mean, I feel like it's the only way for me to actually have my voice effectively heard. Yeah, it's heard, but I'm really not going to change Charlie Rangel or Nancy Pelosi's mind with this book.
And you're there in Virginia, correct?
Oh, well, I'm going to be moving up to Connecticut. I'm going to try to pull Mitt Romney.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess you're probably supporting George Allen there in Virginia.
I'm not too into the local government here or the, you know, actually I'm under Scott Ridgel as my district congressman down here.
Right. George Allen's running against Tim Kaine for one of your
right,
seats
right, right.
There.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know that. I'm just, I saw a big sign today on my, I was riding my motorcycle down. It said Obama Kaine. I was like, whoa. Or Obama and then Tim Kaine. I was like, get out of here.
Keep Bing and I on your Rolodex. Of course, we're friends on Facebook. I'm sure Bing will be sending you one, too. This is what Bing and I do, and we've got friends all over the country that push message for people that are running. This is what we do. This is what we like to do. We get behind somebody, and we can do it from all over the country, and we're a pretty strong army. So you've already got an army behind you, my brother.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm going to need all the help I can get right now.
Well, you just keep us in your Rolodex, and you let us know when you're ready to pull the trigger. And we may not be SEALs, but we're a bunch of damn good grunts.
Hey, you know what? We're Americans.
Hoorah!
That's
I love
true.
It.
Thank you.
Carl, thank you so much for your service. Thank you for joining us today. I'm going to just give a few words with being here, and then I'm just going to finish up with some concluding thoughts about you. So if you want to just hang on the phone for a minute to hear those, you're welcome to. I'll put the archive link on your Facebook page for you as well, sir.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to actually hop off. My wife's calling for dinner.
Understood.
you better do that because if you run for Senate, she might divorce you.
Exactly.
You might as well make it. Yeah.
Do what you got to do now with the wife, because when you get ready to run, we're going to run you ragged.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. I'm going to need it.
All right, brother.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. What a great show, Bing. What a man. Well, I mean, dude, the book is good.
All the way up and down the line, brother. I mean, if I was him at his age to accomplish what he's done so far, I'd be sitting back cheesing like a possum, man. I mean, you know, he just got the whole world ahead of him.
Yeah.
I wish I wish him all the luck, man. Yeah, I hope he runs.
I hope he's one of these young men. You know, you and I being, we're and Don on the other line there, and Kurt, Kurt's our senior, but you and I and Bob, I think we're all probably right around the same age based on when Bob said he served. And I know Kurt would agree with us. We need young men like this Carl Higbee or Matthew Krause, a man I supported to get down in House District 93 down in Austin, who I'd like to see run against Kay Granger in 4 years. These are the people that we need to get groomed and ready to take over our country so you and I can sit back and not have to worry about shit, brother. Bing?
Yeah, I know. Oh, yeah. These are the people that we need to get promoted, that we need to promote ourselves.
Yeah.
We can't just rely on them to promote themselves. We have to promote them, too.
Well, tell us about next Sunday.
Pardon me?
Next Sunday.
Oh, next Sunday, yeah, we got Harry Glossinger on, who wrote the Resident Beanbag Bible. And it's a great book, man. You can get it, I think Adobe, I think, is where he's selling it. Yeah, it's a great read, man. It's just, he overcame a lot of obstacles. He's former military, too. And he overcome a lot of obstacles to get to where he is, you know. And he just has this weird, I wouldn't say weird, it's just a great outlook on life, you know.
Yeah,
the way he looks at things and the way he grew up stuttering. Okay, he had a bad stuttering problem in the Army, I believe, and you know made fun of his whole life and so on. And he turned adversity into something that helped him. And it's just a great book. It's a very good read. Once you start reading it, you really won't put it down. But yeah, he's a great guy.
Well, I've got it downloaded. I'll get it read this week, and we'll get ready. The week after that will be our next Agenda 21 show with Patriot Shar and what's the other lady's name, brother?
Karen Bracken, hopefully.
Yeah, Karen Bracken. So we'll have details on that out. We need to get with Patriot and Karen and have a little powwow so they can tell us how they want their liner notes done. I think Patriot's listening today, as a matter of fact. I'm not in the chat room. Rick logged in to moderate the chat room for us, so I'm not even seeing what's going on in the chat room. But that will be the following Sunday, October the 7th, will be our next Agenda 21. Dude, we've had almost 1,200 downloads on our first series of Agenda 21 from last Sunday.
Yeah, so Shar better make it a good one this week, huh?
Yeah, we've got some big shoes.
Or week after.
Week after next. Yeah, we've set the precedent, Shar. And, that's what happens when you have good people on like Shar, you know?
Yep, and the other guests you had on, they were great.
Kurt Bennett, and John Marler.
Yep.
Yeah, it was a great show. You can catch that in the archives. Well, brother, it is time for us to call it a Sunday. As always, I just want to finish up in conclusion by saying that, Uncle Bing and I, we really are truly blessed to have so many wonderful and concerned patriots that like or enjoy spending a few hours with us on Sunday. It's folks like you that listen to this show that give us the desire to want to continue to do it and continue this struggle and to try to give you the best show we can. I also want to extend the hand of thanks to our guest, Carl Higbee. Carl, you saw our patriot. Let me tie a pretty little bow around everything by saying the lesson I'm now teaching my sons and daughters is character. Not only how you act when eyes are on you, but more importantly, how you act when no one is watching. I have no doubt that the foundation upon which Mr. and Mrs. Higbee raised young Carl to be a man of honor that he is now and will forever be. He's not a summer soldier nor a sunshine patriot. but rather a man that stands by freedom now and always, and deserves the love and thanks of man and woman alike. Patrick Henry once said, "If we wish to be free, if we mean to preserve inviolate those inestimable privileges for which we have been so long contending, if we mean not basely to abandon the noble struggle in which we have been so long engaged, and which we have pledged ourselves never to abandon until the glorious object of our contest shall be obtained, we must fight." I think it's safe to say that Carl has reminded us of the fight we must take to the blathering idiots on the left. For if we do not fight with every bit of our being and change the direction of our country, who will tell the children when divine hope turns to depredation? Who will tell the children when our country is devoid of God and the nation we trust? Who will tell the children when the wheels don't move?
Beyond that hall, we'll explain.